The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaitis, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Werke, the Honorable Theodora Gaitis presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This morning, we are holding court via the Zoom platform. The court has four cases on its calendar today. We'll be hearing two oral arguments, and we have two cases that will be submitted without oral argument. Just a few notes before we begin with our oral arguments this morning. We are recording the arguments that are being held this morning, and those will be available on our website shortly. And with that, I will call our first case. The first case that will be argued this morning is in the matter of the welfare of BCL child, A21-0045. And we have both of our attorneys present with us now. I would just ask you both to please introduce yourselves and identify the party you're representing before you begin your argument. Also be mindful of the time limitations on your arguments. The appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if counsel for appellant chooses to do a rebuttal argument. We're keeping track of the time on our screen. And if I could just have both attorneys nod for me, if you're able to see the clock on the screen. Okay, wonderful. Then I think we're all set to begin. We will first hear the argument from counsel for the appellant. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Juliana Passy from the Kandy Ohio County Attorney's Office on behalf of appellant, State of Minnesota. Your Honors, this case involves a presumptive certification as an adult that the state pursued. In such a case, it is the juvenile's burden, not the state's, to show by clear and convincing evidence that public safety is served by retaining the proceeding in the juvenile court. In this case, the district court abused its discretion in determining that the factors weigh against certification in this particular case, which involves a violent, forcible sexual assault with multiple aggravating factors. The findings of the district court were clearly erroneous on several of the factors that I will discuss. As such, the state would respectfully request that the court reverse the order denying the presumptive certification and remand.
We recognize that BCL would have the burden of overcoming that presumption, but you likewise have a steep burden in terms of convincing us that the district court abused its discretion in terms of its weighing. I mean, would you agree with that?
I would agree, Your Honor, that there is it is now the state's burden on appeal to show that the findings of the district court were clearly erroneous such that its findings were an abuse of discretion.
Doesn't that require a weighing of the factors that prompted this judge to deny certification and go with the EJJ presumption?
Certainly there is weighing involved, but Your Honors, I would point, Judge Werke, I would point you to certain factors that the judge made clearly erroneous findings on such that the weighing of the factors overall would weigh in favor of certification and demonstrate that public safety is not served. In particular, I would point Your Honors to the fifth factor of the 260B.125, which involves the adequacy of the punishment or programming available in the juvenile justice system. The district court's order in this particular case on this factor addressed solely the programming that is available in the juvenile justice system for the juvenile, not the adequacy of the punishment or programming available. Specifically.
Well, here's my question for you on the diversion programs. And I realize that that is what you're saying, is that programming was previously available, but you know, having had my history of being a trial court judge, not every county, not every district, judicial district has diversion programs set up. They seem to be, you know, not a one size fits all. So I'm not certain that we can say this programming didn't work for you if we're going to be trying to look at all juveniles throughout the state of Minnesota on the same basis as far as participation. Can you tell me a little bit about the diversion program, the depth of his involvement that you say indicates and supports that he's not able to participate in programming?
Your Honor is referring to the state's argument on the fourth factor. I was addressing the fifth factor, but I'm certainly happy to address the fourth factor.
I'm so sorry. I thought you were talking about the programming available.
Well, the fourth and the fifth factor are somewhat similar, Your Honor. And the fourth factor is about that is where we made the argument about the diversion programming. And certainly the district court in that case, that's about the programming history of the child that he has already underwent. Our argument on that point is that the district court, despite there being evidence in the record of the diversion programming, failed to take into account the programming that the child had already underwent. Certainly, there is not substantial evidence in the order, Your Honor, regarding the depth of such programming. Indeed, it is mentioned. This is something that the juvenile himself did not disclose to the evaluator, Dr. Aiken, and that came up later. So we would argue that it is erroneous not to take into account that the juvenile, in fact, has had some programming through the courts already. As far as the adequacy of the punishment or programming, the fifth factor, Your Honor, our argument on that point is that the district court, when considering the programming that would be available should the child be found guilty of this offense, the court solely looked at what programming is available in the juvenile justice system in determining that it was adequate, essentially saying that there is programming that would be available for the juvenile. There would be sex offender programming that is adequate. What the court did not do was consider the punishment that the legislature has determined is presumptively appropriate in such a case as this, with the first degree criminal sexual conduct assault of 100.
Oh, can I ask just a quick question? So, following your argument, though, then. And I agree with you. This is a very serious crime, and I am troubled. I'll just be candid about that. But it almost turns this into an automatic adult certification. If you say, well, the adequacy of the punishment is not adequate. Sorry for the repeat verbiage there. When you have a presumptive commit offense. And so help us understand then how does that not just become an automatic, well, it's a presumptive commit and he's only got 4 years left until he turns 21. And so it's not an adequate punishment.
I understand the concern, Judge Siegel. I think the key here is that this was something I think a district court could possibly consider, you know, the 144 months in comparison to the 4 years left in the juvenile justice system and come to the conclusion that possibly they could weigh that and decide, well, it's adequate here for whatever reason. But the point is, in this case, the district court didn't even consider that. The district court did not take into consideration or discuss at all the 144 months, the 10-year conditional release period on top of that the juvenile is facing presumptively. Essentially, it feels like
the record in this case does show that the district court considered the juvenile options. Jones issues the report and says this guy can complete it in the amount of time he would have on EJJ. I mean, clearly, we can read into that the district court is considering and weighing the amount of time, but that's not a hard and fast rule. I guess I'm following up a little bit on Judge Siegel in terms of getting to my question. We're back to the district court making a determination based on the facts available, and I don't know how you can pinpoint something that is so clearly erroneous that we substitute our discretion for the district court in terms of available programming. Can you tell us how we can do that? Is there any fail-safe that this kid is not going to be able to complete the program? I agree, it's a serious offense and we need to make that consideration.
There certainly is no evidence in the record, Your Honor, that the child was not going to be able to complete the program. The evaluator does, both the evaluator and the probation seem to think that there is enough time for them to complete the program. The problem is that programming adequate for this offense here? It's not necessarily, I don't believe that it would have to be an automatic certification, but for the district court to just say that this is,
are we falling into the trap that we're more worried about if a juvenile can complete, if individuals say he can complete EJJ in the 4 years that he has left, rather than public safety concerns, are we more concerned with public opinion that this is a serious offense and gee, he's treated in the juvenile court? Be very wary of that.
I think, Your Honor, the question isn't just if there's adequate programming available. The 260B.125 sub 4, the fifth factor talks about the adequacy of the programming, the adequacy or punishment. The mere fact that the child may be able to complete the programming within the time does not mean that is an adequate punishment or adequate programming, quite frankly, for the offense.
But that's what I mean, adequate to protect the public or adequate to appease public observation of what happens to this kid after this crime is committed. And I think we need to be very careful about that.
I think it's a little bit of both, Your Honor. I mean, certainly there is some public opinion of the, you know, the severity of the offense, but two, you know, the legislature and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has come up with, you know, the 144 months as the presumptive sentence for a reason. That is the determination of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and the legislature about what the adequate punishment is in this scenario. In addition to the fact that here we actually, the state could go and would argue for more than the presumptive sentence because of the presence of aggravating factors in this case.
So Ms. Passy, with regard to the district court's analysis of that fifth factor, what would you have had the district court do to conduct a more complete analysis? What would the prison alternative analysis look like?
Judge Gaitis, I believe the analysis would be to take into account what the presumptive sentence should be taken into account of the sentencing guidelines. I mean, that is the presumptive sentence, and it's presumptive sentence for this particular child because he falls within the presumptive certification motion. So the analysis of the district court should take into account that sentence and weigh the severity of that sentence against the time remaining in the juvenile justice system and the programming that's available in the juvenile justice system, rather than just speaking in the abstract about what can be done in the period of time that is left in the juvenile justice system for this child. And indeed, this court has on numerous occasions looked to that. We cite in our brief the AJF case from this court from 2007, where the court says it is the seriousness of the offenses that make both the punishment and the programming available in juvenile court inadequate to protect public safety. And I think that's true here too. Certainly some rehabilitation may be possible to be done in the next 4 years for the juvenile, but that does not mean that, you know, 4 years worth of sex offender treatments is adequate to protect the public from the possibility that the child may engage in another serious forcible sexual act in the future. On the fifth and the sixth factor as well is about the dispositional options available. I would argue that is the district court's finding on that factor is erroneous as well for the mere fact that the district court appears to acknowledge that sex offender treatment is what is recommended by the evaluator and adopts that. However, the same dispositional options would apply in both are available in both the juvenile justice system as well as the adult system for the child. Therefore, this that factor is most is neutral.
Can you cite to any case law or anything that would support your position that the judge in this case was also supposed to consider what happens through the adult prosecution in terms of sex offender programming and so on? I don't know of any. That's why I'm asking. I mean, you know, there's many things that when you have the commit to prison that you can engage in, and there seems to be more and more programming. I'm just wondering if there's any authority that says the programming available should also be considered in an adult realm.
Your Honor, I did look on that kind of question. I wasn't able to find anything specific in my research when writing my brief. I see that I only have approximately a minute left. I would, on the last fact, I would just like to stress to the court, obviously this is a very serious offense to the case. The court, you know, did recognize that the first factor, the severity of the offense, is supposed to be weighed heavily, as well as the third factor, the prior history of delinquency. Of course, here we don't really have a prior history of delinquency. However, this is a very serious offense. We've got multiple aggravating factors. We also have to take into account the profound effect on the victim, which the district court did. However, where I think the district court got it wrong is, you know, it certainly said that this factor weighs more heavily, but the kind of the bulk of the order addresses the programming that is available, the program that the child could undergo in the juvenile justice system. And the state would argue that the findings on the programming history, the findings on the adequacy of the punishment in particular, is clearly erroneous, such that this court should reverse that finding. And indeed, if the court would agree, there's at least three factors that weigh in favor of certification: the severity of the offense, the culpability of the child, and the adequacy of the punishment. Two at most are neutral: the dispositional options and the programming history. And then the prior record would be the only one that the state would say weighs against certification. So we would ask that the court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Passy. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to give a rebuttal argument. And now we will hear from the respondent. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Drake Metzger, and I represent the juvenile respondent, BCL, in this matter. The district court order denying adult certification should be affirmed because respondent did show by uncontradicted, clear, and convincing evidence that retaining this matter in EJJ serves public safety. The district court does have considerable latitude in deciding whether to certify a case for adult prosecution, and its decision will be reversed only if there's a finding that is clearly erroneous, so as to constitute an abuse of discretion. Now here, the judge's findings were based on the two reports that were submitted at the certification hearing. Both of those reports requested and found that EJJ would serve public safety and requested EJJ instead of adult certification. Therefore, the judge's findings are based on the record and are not clearly erroneous, and therefore the ultimate denial of adult certification was not an abuse of discretion. Now, in reviewing those findings, this court does not reweigh the public safety factors, but determines whether or not the findings were just lack support in the record and if an error of law was made. So here, looking at those factors, I'll start, there was a lot of discussion on the adequacy of the fifth factor, the adequacy of punishment or programming available in the juvenile system. I think it's important to note that on that factor, it is programming available in the juvenile system. I'm not aware of any authority that requires findings to be made as to what programming is available in the adult system. But that said, adequacy of the punishment is what the state wants to focus on. Essentially, the state seems to be wanting to say, here's what the presumptive sentence would be. And therefore, since we're not even close to that in the juvenile system, it's not even close to adequately addressing the punishment aspect of that element.
Well, here's the problem I have with your argument and your presentation, your briefing. You know, this is a very serious offense. This is an older child. This is offense against a person that if there's a likelihood of reoffending, it's going to be, I shouldn't say it is, I'm predicting what kind of an offense there would be. My concern about public safety is BCL in his examinations doesn't really acknowledge his culpability in this. He maintains his innocence. Should we not pay attention to that out of concern of public safety?
Well, and I think the court addresses that as did Dr. Akin. And I think it's important to keep in context the stage that the proceedings were at here. We're still pretrial. This is right out of the gate in terms of the juvenile case. And at this point, the juvenile is maintaining his innocence. However, for purposes of this analysis, we assume everything is true in the complaint. And so when going through the evaluation with Dr. Akin and looking at those evaluation tests, with the presumption that everything is true in the petition, Dr. Akin specifically notes that essentially the only risk factors that are found in those evaluations are directly related to the fact that he's maintaining his innocence. And so certainly I understand that there is concern for him maintaining his innocence, but I don't think that discounts the fact that there is adequate programming available to address that. Dr. Akin specifically found that programming which should specifically address peer group settings that would hold him accountable and would help him get to the point where he would be accepting responsibility and addressing those issues specifically. So I don't know that there's necessarily a public safety concern.
Well, it is kind of a funny statute, the presumption. I've always thought of that in terms of the presumptive commits, because as you said, they haven't had their day in court yet, whether there's a guilty verdict or not, or whether they plead, but yet we're deciding what programming would be out there. It just seems kind of backwards. So I appreciate your comments on that.
Well, and I think that's exactly the issue. And in terms of looking at the evaluations that were conducted, I think it's noteworthy that he was still found at very low risk to recidivate. And while there is some concern arising 100% because of his maintaining his innocence, it's because of this unique situation at the timing of this evaluation that I think gives rise to that. But that said, I think that the state points to the unpublished, I believe it was AJF case. Now, that is a case where there was, I believe, a 408-month presumptive commit. There was an indictment for first-degree murder, charges for second-degree murder, and a slew of other very serious offenses at issue in that case, including murder as well as criminal sexual conduct. And in that case, this court noted the merit to the argument that assessment of the adequacy factor should include more than a mathematical comparison of juvenile versus adult. And so therefore, essentially what the state wants to do is say, well, there's 144-month presumptive commit, 4.5 years in the juvenile system just isn't enough. And under that reasoning, there will never be a situation where EJJ will be enough, quite frankly. And so, you know, essentially the state is asking this court to make the severity of the offense dispositive of this issue. And I think that's deeply concerning, given that it's clearly not what the statute intends. Now, as it relates to AJF, I do think that this is a very distinguishable fact pattern in this case, because here, while this is a very serious offense, and I'm not discounting that fact, I think everybody agrees this is a very serious offense. That is not the only factor to carry the day. And clearly the court here did give greater weight to that factor. I think it's disingenuous to say that it didn't. It specifically said that it gave greater weight to that factor, but it also discussed in its order that it's a very serious offense. It discussed that there's two aggravating factors present, and it also discussed the impact on the victim. And it also, in the hearing, the presumptive 144 to, I believe it was 172-month commit was discussed. I do think all of those things were before the court. Clearly, the court did consider those things. And then again, as it relates to the adequacy of punishment, discussed in the hearing was the fact that local confinement is always available. and that local confinement can be part of any EJJ proceeding. So local confinement could be part of that, either right after he's placed on EJJ or down the line if there's a violation of his conditions on EJJ. So there is a local confinement aspect that was discussed and clearly considered by the court. Ultimately though, Dr. Aiken found that overall, that EJJ was supported by the programming available and that within the time remaining for the juvenile, that EJJ could be completed and that he could be fully rehabilitated, or complete that programming. Some of the other issues that the state took with the district court's conclusion is that the programming history weighed in favor of certification. Now, the court found that the programming history here for BCL did support EJJ. Now, the state says that the court ignores that the respondent's participation in two prior diversion programs didn't deter him from committing this offense. I think that's difficult to discuss because the record does not shed very much light on those diversion programs. The only...
maybe not on the programs, but I was concerned about the fact that he said the photograph thing, the nude pictures in light of what he's charged with now. You know, it looks as if there's a little bit of an escalation, but that's not an informed thought. I was just concerned about that.
Well, in any event, I think the only references made by the juvenile's mother in the interview with, or in her conversation with Dr. Aiken, and that's contained in Dr. Aiken's report. But as it relates to both diversion programs, what she says is all he was required to do is remain law abiding, and I believe write an apology letter for breaking a fishing rod or something like that. And so these are not programming in the sense that it's not rehabilitative programming or anything like that. So I don't know that necessarily counts against that factor. And also the state takes issue that respondent was deceitful in his interview, not specifically referencing a couple of details as it relates to, I believe, being suspended twice instead of once, losing his job, and I believe these two prior incidents that his mother referenced the diversion program for. There's no information in the record that details the level of deceit or the level of omission as it relates to those. Now, he didn't reference those. He didn't state those things, but there's no information in the record that states if he was asked and just denied it or asked and straight lied about it. So I think it's still the programming factor still weighs in favor of EJJ. And I would also point out that programming history doesn't mean just being truthful. I think the state is trying to argue that the potential deceitfulness means that he's unamenable to any programming. And the factor is programming history. And the judge at the district court correctly found that the programming history showed that BCL is willingly participating in individual therapy. He's willingly taking his medications and that he is currently working towards his diploma. So I do think that factor does weigh in favor of EJJ. Now, I believe some of the cases that were cited, PCT, in-rate PCT, I think is instructive because there's clear error, but there's in each of the cases where this factor is weighed in favor of certification, there's essentially multiple attempts at prior programming that has ended in failure, multiple attempts at trying different treatment programs or different placement programs and either absconding from those programs or just not taking them seriously and quitting them. That's not what we have here. The only programming history we have is that the juvenile is participating willingly and that's in the findings and that's supported by the record. So I do think that factor does weigh in favor of EJJ. Now, I guess I won't circle through all the factors again here, but I do think that the court did give adequate weight, greater weight, to the factors 1 and 3 as required. And I think if you look at all the factors as a whole, the judge correctly found that EJJ is appropriate in this case and does support public safety or serve public safety. As far as the factors as a whole go, you do have one of the greater weighted factors in each column. And I think there's more than enough reasonable evidence, credible evidence in the record to support the judge's findings as it relates to the remaining factors and the ultimate determination that EJJ does serve public safety. And unless the court has any additional questions, I will sit back down.
Okay, I'm not seeing any additional questions. Thank you for your argument, Mr. Metzger. And now we'll turn back to Ms. Passy. Would you like to give a rebuttal argument?
Briefly, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you. With regard to the child's programming history, the factor is not just the programming history. It specifically includes the child's past willingness to participate meaningfully in available programming. So Mr. Metzger's argument was essentially that, you know, the child's lack of candor about in his interview with Dr. Akin wasn't relevant or doesn't fall within the factors. I think it definitely falls within the factors in light of he did not disclose to Dr. Akin the past diversion programming that came into the record and into Dr. Akin's knowledge through the juvenile's mother. The fact that he does not disclose this means, of course, that Dr. Akin is unavailable to even consider or talk, you know, to probe into was the child in fact amenable to, was he willing to participate in the past programming? What was his participation like? What did he think about it? How did he think he would, things would go going forward? So I think the fact that the child was certainly he was deceitful on certain facts. He failed to state, he said that he had never been fired from a job. That was untrue. He said that he had one suspension from school when he had two. There were certainly some parts of deceit, but even if it's just leaving out, you know, the fact that he's had prior contacts with law enforcement that do include, you know, sexual conduct of some sort, I think is particularly troubling and should weigh against the programming history being in favor of the child, or weighing against certification, I guess, because the evaluation was incomplete on that factor because of the child's lack of candor. As to Mr. Metzger's pointed to a case that talked about, you know, the evaluation isn't just mathematical, and that's certainly not what the state is arguing for this case. We're not saying you just compare the amount of programming left with the presumptive sentence. It should not be automatic, but it should be a consideration for the courts to think about and to compare the severity levels in its written order so that, you know, everyone is aware that this is something that the court is thinking about, that is taken into account. You know, it wasn't just a stray comment at the hearing. This is something that the district court thought about when considering whether or not the programming or the punishment was adequate for the crime in this case, which of course here is a very serious crime. Unless the court has any further questions, I would ask that the court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for your helpful arguments this morning. The case is now submitted and we will be issuing our decision within a statutory timeframe.